And then I got ran ragged every direction from Sunday, you know, going back and forth from Kuwait and whatever the commander, we need more tents, we need a better generator. These guys over here, they're trying to make them do KP. So I'd go over there and say, listen, if you guys figure these Amos folks out to be KP, then obviously you don't need them. I'm going to take them. And so I'd take them back and redistribute them, or they'd get religion and leave them alone. I mean, you know, they need to be able to go when there's a casualty and they're looking at them thinking they're just sitting around doing nothing.
Veterans Voices, The First Gulf War, is produced by AMPRS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, and is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
The Dakota brings you Asleep at the Wheel, live and on stage, Sunday, May 11th. Asleep at the Wheel has been up, down, and all around, bringing their signature brand of country and western swing to the world since 1970. Touring with their latest release, Half a Hundred Years, it's a 50th anniversary celebration of song and friends that have made them a monument of the American music landscape. The lineup has changed over the years, but Asleep at the Wheel just keeps on rolling along. Tickets for Asleep at the Wheel can be found at the Dakota website. Visit dakotacooks.com for more details.
From the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida, welcome to Indigenous in the News. I'm your host, Larry Kay from the Ho-Chunk Nation, along with Gary Wilcox from the Powhatan Nation. Today, we're honored to welcome Sasha Wurzel, a filmmaker whose work bridges the worlds of environmental justice and untold histories. Sasha's latest film, Rivers of Grass, is a poetic journey through the Florida Everglades, weaving together memory, ecology, and the voices of those connected to the land. A native of Florida and a former artist in residence in the Everglades, Sasha brings forward stories that connect us to place, purpose, and preservation. Welcome to Indigenous in the News. I'm Larry Kay, and joining me is Gary Wilcox. How you doing today, Gary?
Doing good. How are you doing, Larry?
I'm doing well. Join the heat. Join the heat. That's for sure.
Today's guest will be talking about the Florida Everglades and introduce us to her film, new film, The River of Grass. Let's welcome Sasha Wurzel. Hello, Sasha. How are you today?
Hi, I'm good. It's so nice to be here. Thank you for having me, Gary and Larry.
Yes. Hello, Sasha. Welcome to the show. Nice to have you on and see you again.
good to see you again.
Yeah, this past weekend, Sasha was in my town, Bradenton, and she gave us a great presentation on her film. So we're going to hear all about it. So,
well, let's get started, Sasha. River of Grass. Tell us about the film, what it's about, and how did this whole project begin?
Yeah. Thank you again for having me. It's really such a treat to be here with you all.
Yeah.
River of Grass is my sort of ode or love letter to the Florida Everglades, which is the ecosystem that I grew up in. And it's also, you know, a love letter to the people who are caring for this place, but not just the people, also to the plants, the animals, the waters. And this project really grew out of, honestly, having been born and raised there, over many years, just in my lifetime, witnessing so many of Florida's wild spaces, wetlands and waters, places that I have found so much refuge and joy in growing up, just disappear.
Yes.
Fundamentally change or just completely disappear, right? And honestly, the project started because I was feeling a lot of grief about that and realizing that I didn't quite understand why this was all happening and how we got here. That had not been necessarily something that was in my education, that there were some gaps, right, in my knowledge of the history of Florida and of the region, and wanting to find that out. I had, you know, I grew up there, and I'd been living in New York, where I'm based currently now, and I'd been making a lot of work about sites and stories and figures in history who've been excluded from the historical record or systematically erased, and realized that there were a lot of stories where I'm from at home that I didn't know. And so I applied to an artist residency in the Everglades National Park called ARI, Artists in Residence in the Everglades, and with the intention that I would spend that month really spending time in the Everglades and getting to know the ecosystem, meeting people, doing initial research, and that I was going to read this book, The Everglades River of Grass by Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, which is still considered today sort of the resource guide to the Everglades, even though it was written in 1947. So I thought, okay, this is where I'll start. I'll read this book, I'll spend time in the Everglades, and I'll meet people and then see how that maybe comes together in a film. So that's really where everything began.
And what year, when did this all take place, did you say again?
Oh yeah, good question. So I was in residence in the park in November 2017. So directly after Hurricane Irma. And also after, in 2016, we had these massive, you may recall, probably was affecting your area further north in Bradenton and Sarasota too, just a really prolonged toxic algae bloom on the coast with massive fish kills. That was kind of the context. And when I arrived at the Everglades National Park, I was staying in the Southern Glades. They put the residents in ranger housing. So I was living there in the park, and there were trees down. It was very, very flooded still, more than it should be, even though it was, the beginning really, nearing, you know, slowing down the rainy season, coming to the end of hurricane season, but just water everywhere. A lot of places closed, phones were down. It was actually very hard to communicate. I didn't have any cell service. I didn't have Wi-Fi. I could go to the ranger offices and get a little bit of Wi-Fi and make some calls there. But so I was very, in a way that was really good for me, unplugged and just very present. Sure. And to find people required me to really go intentionally make a phone call and physically drive to them and spend time with them in person.
Welcome to Native.
So Marjorie played a big role in your storytelling.
Yeah, she did. Bigger than I intended or expected, honestly.
Right. How did your relationship with the Miccosukee community begin, and what did building that trust look like throughout the making of the film, Rivers of Grass?
My first memory, or I guess my first relationship, was when I was very young, probably, 4 or 5 years old. Someone gifted me a Miccosukee patchwork dress in my family, but I don't think anyone explained very much about it. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I just loved this dress and wore it all the time. It was probably inappropriate for this little white girl to be wearing this dress, but my first encounter was just being like, wow, this is a beautiful work of art. I didn't know why, but I was drawn to it. And then when I started this project, I knew that one cannot make a film about the Everglades and not include and actively engage with Indigenous voices in the region.
Hey.
So I had read about this Two-Spirit artist and poet, Miccosukee poet, Houston Cypress. And I knew that he was involved in this organization that he'd founded, Love the Everglades Movement. And when I came down to, before I went down to do my residency in the park, I just reached out to Houston, I think probably on Facebook, and asked if we could talk, and things kind of started there and continued while I was down there. We met up, I think, for the first time in person outside at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Archives at University of Miami. And then I went on one of these incredible tours that he does in the Everglades, bringing together artists, scientists, activists, scholars, people from all walks of life who maybe have never even imagined going into the Sawgrass on these airboat rides. And from there, I just started learning so much and developing a relationship with Houston. And also, while I was in residence in the Everglades National Park, I knew of Betty Osceola because she had been in the news for leading these prayer walks and these spiritual actions, especially with Bobby C. Billy. And so I just reached out to her too. I just sent her an email and she said, yeah, let's meet. I met her at Buffalo Tiger Airboats on Tamiami Trail, and she and her late husband, Jimmy, I just told them, you know, I'm thinking about making this film. I'm just doing research. And she said, okay, they put gas in the airboat. And she said, get on. We went for a long ride.
That's funny.
I learned so much in just that one moment. And when we got back off of Sawgrass and onto land, she told me that she was planning a prayer walk around Lake Okeechobee. And that it would be, you know, 7 days of walking the entire circumference of the lake, about 118 miles. And she invited me to join, and I did. And so that's kind of where things began.
Sure.
Amazing. You touched a little bit about working with Betty, but can you, and, you know, she's a respected Miccosukee elder and environmental activist, as you said. But tell us, what was it like to actually work with Betty? And how did her perspective help shape the narrative of the film?
This film is so directly rooted in what I've learned in spending time with Betty and her teachings. The first thing that comes to mind is, I think in one of those first meetings, Betty spoke about and often speaks about, you know, that to heal our environment, to heal nature, we have to also heal ourselves.
Hey. Yeah.
And that really became a central kind of theme or, you know, idea in the film and frankly in my life over this period of time and continues to be. And yeah, I think that the experience of joining, particularly the prayer walk around Lake Okeechobee, and very intentionally walking with her and with people who would come in and out. I walked the entire way around the lake. It helped me to remember how to listen in a different way. And I think that that durational act of walking and listening is a critical part of the film, and the walks became really a structural device for how the story would unfold. That through walking with Betty, not just around the lake, but we walk Loop Road, we walk Tamiami Trail, you know, we walk a lot of different areas of the Everglades. That durational act of walking geographically transports us across the landscape and brings us to these different distinct ecosystems that are together collectively form the Everglades. And that walking and listening also sort of, maybe in a more metaphorical way, transports us across time and space and history. Because you feel, you know, when you really do slow down and listen and you're present, I believe you can feel kind of, even if you can't see it, the traces of, you know, what's come before, what's passed through that space.
Sure.
And that it is inextricably shaping our present moment. And so working with Betty and walking, that really became, yeah, that act of listening and that movement became kind of a through line through the film.
Nice, nice. Can you talk about the importance of the indigenous leadership in the fight to protect the Everglades? And how did that message come through in your film?
Another thing I remember Betty saying to me earlier on in the process was that the Everglades had protected her people, the indigenous people of the Everglades, particularly during, you know, through providing food, water, life, sustenance, right?
Sure.
And also through a really awful time in American history, the Seminole Wars and the, indigenous removal, the violent, efforts of the United States government to actively remove indigenous people. And that was a really important part of the story to talk about, to engage with. And she said that, you know, and now the Everglades needs our protection. And so I am very grateful that I have been able to listen to and follow the leadership of indigenous educators and activists like Betty, like Houston, and to follow their leadership and to join in these actions and to be part of a broader coalition of Floridians who are really coming together to deepen their relationship with the environment and protect her.
Were there any specific teachings, stories, experiences shared by Betty and others of the Miksuki community that deeply impacted your understanding of this land, of the Miksuki land and also the Everglades?
One I think about a lot is this idea that both Betty and Houston spoke about to me in the film, is this idea of land as relative and as ancestor. And this is also interesting. When I was reading Marjorie's book, River of Grass, I was struck by the fact that she intentionally uses the plural non-binary pronoun they to describe the Everglades, right? That they are not just one thing, right? And I was thinking a lot about those Miksuki teachings of, you know, this tree and this land is your relative and ancestor. And then this idea of they, the Everglades, from Marjorie, and how that sort of connects us to this more expansive understanding of what family can be and of kinship, you know, that they, it's not just among people, it's among us and the water and the plants and the animals, and how if we all thought of we in this expanded sense, what that might do. Another thing that struck me was learning about how before Florida was, before the Everglades were really re-engineered, the water flow to when they, the lake used to, you know, during the wet and the dry, learning more about the wet and the dry cycles and learning about how that lake during the wet season would really overflow, and how people who are living in and around the lake seasonally kind of moved with the water. And that really struck me, this idea of moving with the changing weather, moving with the cycles, rather than fighting the cycles and imposing our own control and desires on them. I think was a really important thing to meditate on that I took away.
Today, our guest is Sandra Wurzel, filmmaker, artist, and storyteller, whose work explores the intersections of memory, land, and identity. Her latest film, Rivers of Grass, takes us deep into the Florida Everglades, where ecology, history, and indigenous resistance converge.
To learn more, visit them on their homepage at riversofgrassfilm.com and sign up for their newsletter. And visit them on their Instagram at riverofgrassdoc. What responsibilities did you feel as a non-Indigenous filmmaker in telling a story rooted in Indigenous lands? And how did you navigate that while collaborating with Betty and others?
Wow. Yeah, that's an important question. And, you know, something I'm still navigating and will continue to navigate. And as I mentioned earlier, I knew that one cannot make a film about the Everglades and not actively include and engage Indigenous voices and stories in the region. And so one thing that happened early on was I asked Houston Cypress if they would come on as a consulting producer. So someone who from early on is part of the process from beginning to end and can act as, you know, another sort of resource, another guide. And so that there would be, and so that there'd be, you know, not just, I think that in unfortunately documentary, as we know, also has a very colonial history, right? And othering and has all sometimes been weaponized to other communities. And so well, very important from the start to not just have Indigenous people on screen and in the film, to also have Indigenous voices engaged in the process. And so that unfolded more formally with Houston through this role where I could come to for advice, run ideas by him. We also read Douglas's book, The Everglades River of Grass, together, and then had conversations about it, picked out passages that moved us, talked about things that were outdated or problematic. So I really give a lot of credit to Houston for that partnership. And then it was really important also to, I screened the film for Betty and Houston when it was very far along, but not locked, you know what I mean? So that there was an opportunity to just gauge things and get some feedback. And I think that also something that came about, I hadn't always intended to include my own voice in the film, which Larry knows from seeing it, that there is a narrator and that my memories and my perspective is very much kind of a through line, a sort of container to hold all these different parts. And I think that was an important way also of navigating these questions of representation, subjectivity, to be very upfront about whose perspective is this? Who am I? What's my relationship to this place and to the people that I'm filming?
Wow. Good one. Do you see the River of Grass film here as a form of resistance? And if so, against what personal connection?
What do you think, Larry? Is it a form of resistance?
It's grown into a form of resistance, I can see. And our job is to fix it. And you've laid a good road, a nice path for us to follow. So it's just a matter of...
Thank you. I think, I don't know that the film started with the intention, like, I'm going to make this piece of resistance art.
Right.
However, Yeah, I do think, I hope that it is a form of resistance in a way. I think to love is a form of resistance.
Mm-hmm. Right on.
And at its heart, this film is about loving the Everglades.
Sure. And memory. You brought back memory. So we have things to fix to keep that memory alive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think I have just found that even with all the human created destruction and accelerated mm-hmm. climate emergency, human accelerated climate emergency, the Everglades is still abundant. It's still a place of joy and resistance.
Yes, yes. How has your response been from environmental and indigenous communities so far?
We have screened the film only, at three film festivals so far. So we're really early in sharing the film. So, so still just seeing what the response is. I'll say that, so we world premiered the film at this wonderful festival called True False out in Missouri. And then we had our Florida premiere at the Miami Film Festival, which is really special to bring the film home and to screen it not only to a local audience, but with most of our crew, many of the people in the film, many of the just the broad network of people who really were part of making this, whether it was just offering a ride or information through a phone call or connecting me to someone. So far, it seems to be really resonating with people. We had our first screening in Miami was sold out. Right. The festival added a second screening. It sold out. They added a line of folding chairs in the theater to accommodate everyone. The Q&As have been really engaged. And similarly in Sarasota, where Larry mm-hmm. saw the film. So we're just at the beginning, but I've been really, really pleased that the film is getting such a wonderful reception. So
is it coming to Miami, or has it came here yet? Or
yeah,
we screened in Miami a few weeks ago, but we'll be back. I know, I'm sorry about that, but we'll be back. Our goal, right now we're in the early stages of releasing the film, so we're bringing the film to film festivals, screening series. We intend to have some kind of theatrical release in New York and also in Miami later in the year. And at some point the film will become more accessible, hopefully through streaming. But one thing that me and my incredible team really want to do is to partner with folks throughout the state of Florida, environmental organizations, people in the film to host local community events and screenings. So there will be a lot more of that, and I'll make sure that you're there, Gary.
Yes, yes.
At one of those events.
Keep us in mind. We'd like to partner up with you. We'll spread the word however we
can. Yeah, that would be great. I would love that.
Sure. What's next for Rivers of Grass? Will there be any public screenings, installations, or educational partnerships? And what is the best way for our listeners to get a hold of you?
So next up for the film River of Grass, we're traveling to Toronto for international premiere at Hot Docs mm-hmm. next week. Then we'll come to New York City for our New York premiere at the American Museum of Natural History on May 4th as part of the Margaret Mead Film Festival. And we'll continue to screen in film festivals and screening series, throughout the year.
Yes.
With the intention that we will come home to Florida again to have a series of community screenings and events.
All right.
With people in the film, and partnering with folks like you and mm-hmm. environmental organizations across the state of Florida. And if you want to follow along, get updates, the best place to find us is on our website, riverofgrassfilm.com. You can sign up for our newsletter, and we also have an Instagram account, riverofgrassdoc.
Sweet. We'll be there. Nice to have you on the show and learn all about the film. I'm so happy that I did have a chance a couple of weeks ago to see it, and we'll bring it to Gary real soon and the rest of our listening audience. It'll be coming to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous in the News and supporting us and our entrepreneurs. Indigenous in the News has been produced by Larry Kay. Our engineer is Paul Salvatore. Our theme music is composed by Lenny Long. Today's show has been recorded at the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida.